When we think of some of the greatest inventions ever, some of the greatest inventions would be gunpowder, cotton gin.
The plow.
The plow. I got one that tops all those easily. Sex.
Oh, that's a fabulous invention. I mean, it's all here because of that.
Exactly.
Sex.
Exactly.
Hi, welcome back. This is Janaea Donaldson with Peak Moment TV, and I'm conversing with Derek Jensen, author of the most recent book, The Myth of Human Supremacy. We were talking about kind of the symphony of life, of finding your part. And you had mentioned earlier, you know, the survival not of the fittest, but those that fit together. I really love that notion. So I'm going to say, do you believe in God when you look at all this marvel?
I believe in something. And I mean, I certainly don't believe in the Christian God. Well, actually, this is an important thing, that I think that one of the most powerful things that the Abrahamic religions have done is that they created a distant sky God who is not embedded in this.
Right here.
And so meaning was removed from this tree and this tree and this fern and taken somewhere out there. And that, in many ways, I think, is one of the sources of the problems. So I don't believe in that God. There is some animating force or something. I mean, I often wonder, I mean, life is so complex and so extraordinary, and even our individual bodies are so extraordinary and complex. I was sitting next to the ocean with a friend of mine who's a fisheries biologist. And so I turned to him and I said, he actually goes to church every week. I said, do you believe in a God then? And he said, no, not really. I go to church for, you know, just for community. And he said, no, I don't believe in a God. And I don't believe that there was someone designing all this. But I believe that there is great intelligence in time. And I love that. And it doesn't really matter to me whether there is some overarching intelligence who is sort of figuring out these things, or whether it is all of these individual and communal individual plants and their communities figuring out these things. It actually doesn't matter to me, but what is very clear to me is there is tremendous intelligence in all of these creatures and in how they work together. And the same is true in our bodies. You know, I've got coronary artery disease. You know, my arteries are getting plugged with plaque. And I went to the, so at first I didn't have any insurance. And so I couldn't pay for the tests. And so I was presuming it was heartburn instead, because, which is a very stupid way to make a decision. But I mean, gosh, on any larger issues, have we ever heard of anybody not acknowledging a more problematic diagnosis because that would be involve larger changes? I can't come up with any, actually.
We don't have anything in our culture, our politics. No. Right. Okay.
Okay. So anyway, that was what I was doing.
Okay.
But I was actually getting better. And so when I talked to the cardiologist, he said, no, you got coronary artery disease. I said, well, why was I getting slightly better over the last few months? And he said, it's because your arteries, your body knows that it was clogged, that these arteries are clogged, and so it sends out capillaries to go around the blockage.
Oh.
And it actually knows where to send them. And so it's extraordinary to me that when a human being goes under anesthetic and has bypass surgery, we think that's a miraculous intervention. But when our bodies do it themselves, then that's not a miracle. Even that language is really problematical. Why did I just say our bodies do it themselves? Why did I not say when I did it? Why am I counting myself as my thoughts, but I'm not counting myself
as
my
body?
As my
Well, because your brain is not in control of. I mean, think that control is going to be a big piece of this. You didn't control consciously.
But that's part of my body.
But your body did.
My body did.
It knew what it was doing.
And see, this goes to a larger issue, too. So, I'm not going to ask you to do this because you've read the book. I want people who are listening to this to think of their favorite three pieces of art in the world. Most beautiful. I mean, I'm just going to cliche. I mean, Mona Lisa, Sistine Chapel, and name one.
Oh.
Beethoven's song.
Sure.
So whatever.
We'll go with that.
It's like, what about Birdsong? What about sunset over the ocean?
What about the ripple of the stream behind
us? What about the ripple of the stream?
Right.
Why is it that when humans create something beautiful, we think that it is a great achievement? And when nature creates something beautiful, or when an individual in nature creates something beautiful, that is not a creation. When we think of some of the greatest inventions ever, some of the greatest inventions would be gunpowder, cotton gin.
The plow.
I got one that tops all those easily. Sex.
Oh, that's a fabulous invention. I mean, it's all here because of that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Some of the bacteria are saying, actually, no, you don't. Sex is not that great. We don't want to bother with it. But it's like, so why is it that or proprioception is an amazing thing. Proprioception is how do you know where your hands are?
Okay. This
was developed at some point. I mean, we have to have it, otherwise we couldn't walk. We couldn't do anything. You have to know where your hand is to be
able. Senses are.
But it's an extraordinary thing when you actually think about. You know, okay, so my hand's back here, but I still know where it is. And I was thinking about this one night in the middle of the night because I was very groggy and for like five, and I was going to reach up for the water at the top of the bed. And I reach up and for just, you know, in that half, three quarters of sleep state, I actually forgot how to do proprioception somehow. It's like, I can't tell where it was. Where's my hand?
Mm-hmm.
It lasted for like a second until I woke up. Mm-hmm. That startled me into wakeness. It's like, oh, it's actually right here.
Mm-hmm.
But there's all these things that it's incredibly narcissistic that basically if we create it, it is special. And if if you wanted to, we could go to the whole patriarchy thing too, that they get so excited when scientists create some amino acids that are 1/100th of the way toward actually creating life in a lab. It's like, oh my God, we've created, we're so brilliant. We're the most amazing creatures in the universe. It's like, rabbits create life all the time.
I want to go back to the notion of intelligences over time. You share with us some amazing intelligences that aren't at all like humans, which of course is part of the point, is that there's a lot of intelligence, including underground in this kind of forest, or including, what is it, the slime mold?
Oh, yeah.
I love the stories of the slime mold.
Well,
particularly when things get going rough.
They
do odd things.
Well, there's a couple things. And this actually goes back to the start of my career. That A Language Older Than Words was originally supposed to be this really happy book about just a whole bunch of collections of interspecies communication. And I tried to write that book for about a year, and I couldn't do it. And eventually I realized why. And the reason I couldn't write that book is because I was going to show that non-humans are intelligent by showing how they can communicate with us. Like if somebody has a dog or a cat, how does a cat or dog let you know that their dog food or cat food dish is empty?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you eventually get it.
Yeah.
And, or I have a friend who has a dog, and that friend went away for a week, and so somebody else was taking care of the dog, and the dog made very clear that this was not a good thing by pooping on the floor. The dog does not normally do that. It's like, how else are you going to express that you're not unhappy, or that you're not happy? There's a pillow, there's my butt. What do you think? Don't do this again, please. I mean, so they have ways to communicate. So that original book, that book was just going to be stories like that. And then I realized that
stories like that would simply, trying to write a book that shows that non-humans can think would be like, it would not question the underlying bigotry that says that their intelligence has to be like ours. Mm-hmm. The only way they're smart is if we can understand that they're smart. Mm-hmm. And so it would be like writing a book that shows that Jews aren't subhuman or that blondes can really think. It wouldn't question
that.
What I wanted to get at, and what I wanted to get with my whole working life, is to get at the underlying bigotry that leads us to devalue their intelligences. So having said that, so there are some pretty cool intelligences in there. We say that one form of intelligence is the ability to use tools. What about if you use another being as a tool? And the truth is that you and I have both been used as tools by non-humans before. Have you ever sneezed?
Okay, sure.
Have you ever had diarrhea?
Yeah.
Then you were used by bacteria
to
help spread their babies.
Oh yeah.
You helped
of
to
course.
Create a new colonization plan. And in fact, bacteria will make communal decisions. Pretty interesting stuff. So bacteria, they will gather, and then when they do something called, I think it's quorum sensing, I believe it is. Anyway, when they get to a certain number, they will decide communally to, it's time that there are enough of us that she needs to have diarrhea. And so they'll wait and gather, and then as soon as there's enough of them, it's like, well, literally.
Time to head elsewhere.
And so how are we going to do it?
Poop them out.
Uh-huh. And in fact, we're going to make it explosive. We're going to spread.
Give us a maximum range that we could.
Yeah.
Which we'd do in the natural world. It would be all over.
Yeah.
All right.
Also, bacteria, it ends up, and this is not me, this is not like woo-woo, this is, even bacteriologists are talking about how there is a universal language, is what they call it, exchanging molecules. It ends up that bacteria will communicate. It's not merely that how they communicate antibiotic resistance is not merely by the ones who survive that have a different genetic situation, and so they are able to survive the antibiotics. In addition, the ones who have the antibiotic resistance can communicate that to other other bacteria.
Okay.
And speaking of antibiotics, that's a great example of what we're talking about. That who invented antibiotics? If you say Alexander Fleming, or who discovered them?
If
you say Alexander Fleming, penicillin, then, well, no, actually. You could say, well, it was Arab stable boys who recognized that horses recovered more quickly from saddle sores if the saddle was moldy. Well, no, it's before that. You could say it's soldiers during the Crusades who recognized that if there was a wound and they put moldy bread on it, they healed quicker. No, you know who really invented it? Mold. Why is it so exciting when we discover a use for it, but mold is actually the one who originally made the bacteria, the antibiotics.
Antibiotics for the bacteria.
So that they did that because I'm going to eat this cantaloupe, not you. So if you come over and eat this cantaloupe, I'm going to kill you. Let's see, what are some others? Plants. Plants, there's this guy who has made a dictionary. Plants are talking to each other all the time. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember his name right now. Stefano Mancuso helped to, he and other people have developed so far a lexicon of, I think, 1,500 different words or phrases. And the way they communicate is chemically. They can't speak. Like, they don't have means to suck in air and then move it past vocal cords.
Right.
But they will communicate to each other through chemicals, through essentially scents, through pheromones, one plant will communicate to another. If there's a caterpillar eating on that plant will communicate to other plants, hey, there's a certain type of caterpillar here, change the composition of your leaves.
To its neighbors.
Well, and that's a pretty interesting thing, too, because even some of the scientists who were studying this cracked me up. Even some of the scientists who were studying this said, gosh, why would a plant expend energy to clue in its competitors that somebody's going to eat them. And when I read this, I wanted to scream, because what they actually suggest is an alternative explanation for it. As they said, perhaps the plant is doing a soliloquy, is talking to itself, so it is basically communicating from this leaf to this leaf. They think that might be a better way to do it than communicating down to the base and then back up. So it's communicating from this leaf to this leaf, and if anybody else gains any benefit from the communication, well, that's just a bonus.
Secondary.
And it's funny, because they always say we should never project onto the natural world, and that's terrible. It's anthropomorphizing. But I'm sorry, you have middle-aged white men saying that plants are basically doing soliloquies, talking to themselves. If anybody else gains any benefit, that's good. It's like middle-aged white men project much. The wanted to scream when I read that is because maybe the reason that these plants would want to clue in their competitors, let's change one word. Why would they want to clue in their neighbors instead of their competitors? Because the plant understands that a forest consists of more than just me. It consists of everybody else.
That's one of the biggest things that I get in reading. It's like, we are all of us, you know, all of us here together, going for the health for all of us, right? I mean, I love the language that you are shifting to in here of, this is a living being. This isn't just a live tree and a live fern and a like, but the whole thing together is a living being. And you use the word who, not which. I think that's a piece of starting to shift our way of looking. It's, if we call all of them who.
Well, I think that's a hugely important thing. And I mean, if you're typing on a word processor and you say the tree who did this, it will try to correct you.
It doesn't like that, huh?
Well, and notice what we're saying. It doesn't like that.
The
computer, it doesn't like it. The point is, we can accept. See, here's the thing that kills me, is people talk about artificial intelligence all the time.
Yeah.
But as soon as you, and then it's like, great, okay, computers are getting smart. And we talk as though they are. But as soon as somebody says the tree who, everybody freaks out. We can accept intelligent computer. We can't accept intelligent plant, intelligent stream, intelligent bacteria. And part of that, I think the part of the reason for that is that machines are our creation.
That's right.
And there is this ego question that if we create it, yes, it can be intelligent. But if nature itself created it, it can't be intelligent, can't have preferences. You know, we say, it doesn't like it when we do that. How many people think, did the forest like it when I did that? Did the forest like it when I cut it down?
We don't ask that. You know, we don't ask that. We don't think of it that way, which is why to think of it as who.
I think that's the first step, and it's a hugely important step to recognize that that tree has preferences. That tree has preferences. And they're not, even though they're both redwoods, that doesn't mean that they're the same preferences.
And they show the preferences. I mean, partly, you know, who's growing it, in which direction, and yeah?
I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's another thing. Humans have done studies on this, that plants, I never thought about this until I was doing research for the book. Plants decide where to grow limbs. And they decide where to grow limbs based on doing basically marginal cost, marginal return analyses of, will it take more energy for me to grow a limb out here than I will gain through the sunlight?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So they actually make intelligent decisions as to where to grow, and they also do this not simply based on current conditions, but based on future conditions in the understory.
Somehow they have to know.
They
have to project the future.
To project for like 5 years. It can take years for a tree to grow a long limb.
Yeah, sure.
So it will project into the future. How is this going to look in 5 years? And they will make decisions that are the proper decision based on energy input, energy received for energy put out. I guess energy return on investment.
Yeah.
And
but the part that, you know, sort of boggles is that they're doing projections into the future.
Absolutely.
I mean, humans would be the only ones thinking that we're the only ones that can do that kind of thing.
Well, which I don't see a lot of going on right now, frankly. And it's the same with they make decisions based on that. Oh, they will also there are some plants who don't need water very often. And they've done this in a lab where they would test, they'll feed them every 6 months or every year, water them every 6 months or a year, and they would find that however the plant would anticipate that this is coming, and it would, I don't know the amount, a few days, a few weeks beforehand, it would start preparing for, I'm going to get watered in that time. So that's another example of that intelligence. One more I want to mention really quickly is fungi. And what they found is that a lot of these trees, like that little tree right there, where's one behind us people can see? A little tree.
And those little skinny trees in the back?
Yeah. So those are not getting enough energy from the sun to live.
Right.
And what they found is if you take that tree out and you put it in a greenhouse, give it only that much light, it dies. So what's happening is someone is deciding that it is, this whole forest is connected through a mycelial mat, a mat of mushrooms.
Underground. Right.
And they're actually taking energy from the trees who have excess, and they're giving it to those who need, the little ones. And so somebody is managing, I hate that word, but somebody is
coordinating.
Thank you. I'll use that from now on. And something we haven't talked about, we've only got like 2 minutes left, something else that is really important is the notion that not just us as individuals are individuals, but that I believe that communities are living beings too.
I'm going to give it to people. It's so gorgeous. And then you can do it. The most important elements in evolution, which means life, are biotic communities who are themselves living beings. Precious.
So I think, I mean, what are you as a body? I mean, for one thing, you've got, you know, 10 times as much bacteria who doesn't have your DNA as, I mean, you are a community.
I'm a community already, of all kinds of
organisms. Of all kinds of beings.
Yes.
And some of whom are simply waiting for you to die and then they're going to eat you.
Okay.
That's part of the
fair.
Deal.
It's fair. It's, yeah.
And there, but essentially, okay, we can think of a forest as, well, water comes into a forest and water passes out of a forest. It sort of carries that. Nutrients come in, nutrients go out. It's the same thing with you. Nutrients, I mean, you drink some water and then you pee it out.
Right.
And so you just sort of carried water around with you. And the forest, the same way. Nutrients come in, nutrients go out. And I don't see, it's just, I'm doing a poor job of it right now, but it just seems so clear to me that we have individual cells in us who are like the individual trees. Mm-hmm. And then we also, on the larger scale, we then make a larger collective. You know, you started by asking if I believe in God, and it's not God, but there are individual cells, and then there's also this larger animating force. And I think that there are individual trees and then a larger animating force. Or our larger animating force is the wrong word, but larger something. That there is a collectiveness.
You know, we're going to struggle with the language for a while, Derek.
Yeah.
Because we're both to undo the mindset we've gotten from this culture about this is just dead material. But I think that I'm so grateful for your, you know, efforts to push that language towards finding out that we're not all alone in this. We're in a big community.
Well, there's a great thing. There was this astronomer that was asked why is it important to explore Mars, and he said because it will answer that most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? And I remember thinking, are you crazy? I mean, that's a more important question, is are you crazy? Because how can he ask if we're all alone when we have all of this? We are not. I mean, we're only alone because we have this self-imposed notion that nobody else exists. Of course you feel like, of course we feel lonely. Of course we feel this deep existential pain because we're not acknowledging that anybody else exists. But we're not actually alone. All we have to do is open up to their existence, and it doesn't mean we're going to like them. It doesn't mean they're going to like us. I mean, we're going to. Oh, I got to tell you this, even though we're going to go over time probably. I just learned the other day. I didn't put this in a book because I learned it way afterwards. That they're starting to be able to discern the language of bats. But what they did is they recorded just thousands of hours of bats in a cave, and they then would correlate the bats' actions with specific sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make a sound, and then I do something, and then this happens 50 different times, they start to figure out what it means. And it ends up that, and this just brings me immense joy, actually, it ends up that bats spend a good amount of their time squabbling.
Are they really squabbling, or do we not yet know that might just be gossip? It might be.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
It's like, so one will go, right, 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 and then the other one moves a little bit away. It's like, so, I mean, I'm absolutely convinced. That's the thing, is when we say, you know, that the natural world, they're all alive, it doesn't mean that they're a bunch of angels or something. It doesn't mean that they.
Like us. They're like. There's nasty kids and there's fine kids and there's crabby ones.
And there's good neighbors and there's I mean, that's the something I think about trees, is trees have to probably be really good at conflict resolution. Because they gotta live, this tree has to live next to this one for 2,000 years. And they gotta get along.
And they are working on a much slower time frame than we are, so they probably have to be really, really good at it.
But I think everybody squabbles.
Sure.
I mean, songbirds, I think that's half their time is spent going, did you see what he did yesterday?
Excuse me, this is my turf. I'm going to check over here. You stay over there. Yes.
Yeah. One last thing is that, you know, Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan Indian writer and activist, she said to me, you know, we Indians have the same problems that you white people do. We get in fights, we squabble, we do everything. The big difference is we're going to live here forever. And so I know that my great-grandchildren might marry your great-grandchildren. So we have to come up with conflict resolution methods that allow us to live in place. And the same is true with non-humans. If you're planning on living in place for 500 years, you have to come up with conflict resolution methods. How can I live? How can you live? How can we get along? Mm-hmm. Not just with, you know, you and I are hanging out here today, or the three of us are hanging out here today, and that's all great. And I enjoy, you know, the time I've spent with you. And if the three of us were all living in an 8x8.
Living in our RV, in a little space.
Then we would have to have different discussions.
Absolutely.
And it's the same on the larger scale, that we just have to figure out how to get along.
Thank you. You're watching Peak Moment. I'm with Derek Jensen, author of the latest book, The Myth of Human Supremacy. I'm Janaea Donaldson. Join us next time.